The DOJ in 11 states take on Google.
With the timing, 2 weeks until the election, with the president continuing to rail on big tech companies, does kind of make things seem a little suspicious politically.
Also, maybe it's time for a little bit of optimism when it comes to the pandemic. That's according to the New York Times' Donald McNeil Jr.
You know, as Tony Fauci says, we need to hunker down. But I have high hopes for, ultimately, for this all to be over sometime in the first half of next year, I hope.
But first, in 2016, evangelical voters made up a huge part of President Trump's base, but that seems to be shifting now, and you're talking with us about it.
I go to church every Sunday, and I voted for Trump the last time, but I don't see him as a Christian. The things he does and the things he says are the antithesis of my Christianity.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 21st. Over the weekend, President Trump traveled to Nevada to court voters. And while he was there, he made a stop at the International Church of Las Vegas.
Everybody says, we bless you, President Trump.
Come on, stand with us. Come on, release a blessing on him. And on his whole staff. And on the Secret Service. And on our police department.
In 2016, roughly 80% of white evangelicals voted for President Trump. And much of that support can be attributed to the president's promise to appoint conservative judicial nominees and to having Mike Pence as his vice president. But faith is not at the center of Donald Trump's personal life, which has included two divorces, accusations of marital infidelity with an adult film star, and the sexual abuse and harassment of women, many of which the president has denied. But some Christians are beginning to question their support for the president. A number of prominent Christian faith leaders have come out in support of Joe Biden. And a recent Pew poll found that the percent of white evangelical Protestants who plan to vote for the president fell from 83% to 78% between August and October. Here's what former Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele had to say about evangelical support of President Trump.
You know, I'm not an evangelical. I'm a Catholic Christian. And I scratch my head at the community, largely speaking, because of the positions it's taken in public and how it has used those views and those positions to chastise and reprimand Americans for their behavior, et cetera. And yet when it came to Trump, they just kind of went, well, that's okay. We get a Supreme Court justice out of this who will overturn Roe versus Wade.
Joining me now is Tara Isabella Burton, journalist and author of Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Chris Romine is an ordained minister of Common Ground, a post-evangelical church in New York City. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Also, John Fia is a history professor at Messiah University and the author of Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
John, let's start with you. Back in 2016, what was the appeal for President Trump among white evangelical voters?
Well, I think you laid it out in the introduction to the piece. Donald Trump was going to deliver on some of the social and moral issues that evangelicals have held dear for years. And, you know, evangelicals, many conservative evangelicals at least, do politics one way, and that is abortion, 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 and then usually some kind of a secondary issue. In this election, in 2016, it was religious liberty. So again, it's a kind of Faustian bargain in which you get your policy proposals put through, you get a Supreme Court justice, and you, to use the words of one of the famous evangelical leaders, Tony Perkins, you give Donald Trump using a golf phrase, a mulligan on all of the immorality and non-Christian behavior that he's done in the past. So it's very much a contractual arrangement.
When we think about evangelical voters, I think there's one image that often comes to mind. But who are evangelicals in the United States? What do the demographics look like right now?
So I think there is often, I think the most important distinction that can be drawn is that when we talk about evangelicals, as particularly Trump supporting evangelicals, what we are talking about is white evangelicals. So the famous 81% number of turnout that we saw in the 2016 election, where 81% of evangelicals, we sort of will say 81% of evangelicals broke for Trump. That is actually the story of white evangelicals. And increasingly over the past few decades, evangelicals have started to look a little different. There are more and more Latino evangelicals, to a lesser extent, Black evangelicals. And what that means is that the evangelical Christianity is becoming more diverse, both because of demographic shift and also because you do have younger people leaving the evangelical church. So the vision of the white evangelical voter that we have is a little bit out of date, or on its way to being out of date.
Are there implications for that? We mentioned in my conversation with former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele yesterday, one of the things he said in our extended conversation was that there are differences among how evangelicals of color may view the president versus white evangelicals. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think that generally speaking, the overwhelming support of Trump on the part of white evangelicals is very much white specific in that way, which is to say evangelicals of color, indeed Christians of color more broadly, massively tend to prefer Biden in almost every poll. You see this as well with, for example, the breakdown between white Catholics and who tend to break, I think it's 54% for Trump, and then Hispanic Catholics who break overwhelmingly, I think it's in the 60s for Biden. So by and large, in pretty much every Christian denomination, not just evangelicals, race is a primary divider of voting outcomes.
Chris, I want to bring you in here because a couple of things. You left evangelicalism prior to the election of Donald Trump. Do you think Trump's presidency has driven more people away?
Yes, absolutely. I was part of an evangelical church. It was the first church I ever went to. And I got hired by it and kind of saw behind the curtain of some of the beliefs that they stood for that were not present on stage, that were not evident. And I exited. And in my exit, as Donald Trump was getting elected, there were networks that were popping up, sort of recovery networks, if you want to call it, people sort of healing, recovering from evangelicalism. And these networks just blew up. They've grown huge. They are helping people exit evangelical churches.
Chris, you are a person of color yourself. How did the way that white evangelicals tend to lean, based on what Tara was just saying?
Yeah, so absolutely. To look at it historically, there's a whiteness problem within American evangelicalism. And for many white folk, they were able to look away or not notice this. But this was ever present for Asian, Latinx, and Black Christians that would call themselves evangelical. What I'm noticing now, definitely in these networks, is that white folks are beginning to wake up and say, this church has insufficiently addressed race and unjust economy. And they're finding their exits. They are leaving. So it is not only that people of color are identifying as evangelicals but not aligning with Trump, but it is also now a white voter block that we're seeing heavy chips in.
John, we mentioned Mike Pence, and how much of a role was did Mike Pence play in exciting the evangelical base for President Trump?
Yeah, I think Mike Pence is actually absolutely essential because Donald Trump delivered on the policy programs, or at least promised to deliver on the policies that evangelicals were concerned about, you know, whether it be abortion, religious liberty, gay marriage, those kinds of things. You know, he would, you know, Israel policy and so forth. But he was not part of the community. He couldn't speak the language. He still can't really speak the language very well of evangelical Christianity. And I'm not just talking about theological language, but there is a certain way in which evangelicals see the world and talk about the world. You know, they talk about, you know, being saved, right? They know how to quote Bible verses, right? They know that it's 2 Corinthians, not 2 Corinthians. Trump couldn't do any of that. Mike Pence certainly could. Mike Pence has a story that is deeply embedded within evangelicalism. He can talk about his conversion experience when he became born again at a Christian rock event in Wilmore, Kentucky. And he has a long history of being part of the Christian right. So from a political standpoint, it was actually a brilliant move to place someone like Mike Pence on the ticket. And the thing about Mike Pence is, of course, he's also very dutiful and loyal. I mean, like many evangelicals, he believes that he should government is ordained by God, even if it's Donald Trump who's leading that government. And he is going to do everything he can to support, based upon his understanding of that. You know, a lot of this comes from the biblical passage of Romans 13, right? Submit to government. Government comes from God. So I think Mike Pence, when, you know, is not going to speak out when you see Donald Trump, you know, acting in a way that's inherently unchristian. He's going to do his duty as a good Christian politician to support the godly ordained government, believing that God has placed Trump here for this particular moment in time. I mean, that's the worldview that Pence is operating under.
I'm wondering also just how critical, Chris, this group is to the overall electorate. We know that according to the Robert P. Jones, according to Robert P. Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute, white evangelicals made up 26% of all voters in the 2018 midterm elections. Does that indicate that that they could be a deciding factor for President Trump this time around?
Unequivocally. And there are some groups that exist to peel some of those voters off of the just GOP ticket voting, you know, down line. There's a group called Vote Common Good that goes across the country and appeals to white voters who have always been aligned with the GOP and appeals effectively to the common good. Is this actually embodying your Christian values? And that electorate, I think, is going to be key in states like Pennsylvania that have a huge evangelical population and have a lot of mega churches that are by and large arguing in a political stance.
Tara, I'm wondering if we can also break down some of the generational differences here. Are we seeing younger white evangelicals who are thinking differently than their older counterparts?
Absolutely. On a lot of sort of hot button issues, particularly things like gay marriage, we find that evangelical millennials and Zoomers, for that matter, are markedly more socially progressive. At the same time, we're also seeing more broadly that many millennials and members of Generation Z are leaving organized religion behind altogether. 36% of people born after, I believe it's 1985, call themselves religiously unaffiliated. So we've got the sort of double whammy of people saying, all right, I'm still evangelical, but I don't agree with my church on these things, and also people walking away altogether.
And are we? And do you think that that could have an effect on the electorate in the next couple of weeks?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it so much depends as well on turnout. And I think that if there are people who are either feel like if they do vote, they should vote for Trump and they're not going to vote at all, or whether that they're no longer feel sort of constrained to vote with their kind of community by voting for Trump, I think we will see younger voters, assuming they kind of show up in particular ways, as a potentially deciding factor.
John, I want to broaden this out a little bit to talk about Christianity more broadly and where a lot of Christians stand right now. Are there deep ideological differences between white evangelicals and other groups of Christians in terms of how they view the president?
Sure, I think there definitely are. I think, for instance, if you look at mainline Protestants, you know, non-evangelical Protestants, I think you'll see a much more divided group on the election. You know, I would think you would have a majority. I think most polls show the majority are leaning more towards Biden. Mainline Protestant Christianity has a much more of a social justice, left-leaning kind of politics. Again, not everybody within mainline evangelicals. You also have a lot of kind of God and country kind of things that could lead towards Trumpism. So I think within mainline Protestantism, you get you know, a sort of much more diverse coalition than, say, the 81% of white evangelicals who voted for Trump. I think among Catholics, I mean, Catholic social teaching, Catholic moral teaching, Catholic political teaching kind of cuts both ways. You know, Catholics are, of course, concerned about poverty. They're concerned about the stranger, immigration. In other words, they're concerned about the environment, you know, these kinds of things. They're also very conservative on, you know, sexual ethics, marriage, and especially abortion. So I think within the Catholic community, you could find people leaning, emphasizing one side of Catholic social teaching and voting for a more liberal candidate like Biden. And then you could also find conservative Catholics who will support Trump because of his views on abortion. So, you know, there. But I would argue that both Catholics and mainline Protestants are going to be much more of a diverse coalition than white evangelicals.
Let's talk a little bit about that, Tara, because Vice President Joe Biden's Catholicism hasn't been, at least yet, central to his election prospects, and yet it has been for Amy Coney Barrett. How do you break that down for us?
Yes, I think particularly in the United States, sort of discourse about sort of the ways in which Catholicism might sort of alter a candidate's perspective tend to sort of fall naturally along the sort of religious, not religious, Christian, or other false dichotomy that often dominates discussions of the American political life. I mean, on the one hand, when we're talking about what's going on in the wider Catholic intellectual community, we have, you know, Pope Francis putting out an encyclical condemning basically global capitalism and wealth inequality. And the fact that these are not kind of front and center as Catholic voting issues, I think, speaks to the way in which religion in America has been kind of reduced to a narrative increasingly set by white evangelicals, and in particular the alliance, which we've seen since the days of Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority, between a certain kind of white evangelical inflected vision of theology and politics that kind of sets the tone for the debate. Biden's Catholicism, while he certainly refers to his faith, well, that's as indeed has pretty much every single presidential candidate in any election, it hasn't gotten attention precisely because the issues he's talking about, including things like wealth inequality, don't have the same cultural valence as abortion, which is the point on which I think Amy Coney Barrett's Catholicism, abortion and gay marriage or gay rights more broadly, are these issues that sort of dominate what it means to be religious and voting religiously, which I think is a real mistake and a sign of the way in which this country has often collapsed religious discourse into something rather simplistic and based only on certain political shibboleths, shall we say.
Chris, I think that's a really interesting point, because we know that, as was mentioned earlier in the conversation, less Americans are following organized or traditional religion today. And I wonder if, as that continues to happen, whether political parties will spend less time courting those voters overall on both sides of the political divide. I mean, there was just an article in the Times about how the Mormon community in Arizona is fed up with the president. So how important will these groups continue to be as we move forward?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think Tara maps it really well. I think the answer that I would have, based on the denominations I'm a part of and affiliated with, and the church planting networks that I'm a part of, is it will become less obvious what the evangelical bloc is. It will be less concentrated and held together, because as we see membership decline across all evangelical denominations or networks, and by and large, church attendance go way down, church giving go way down, and church distrust go way up, what we're noticing is that you can't really point as much directly to an evangelical voting bloc because less people are participating in evangelicalism on a whole and Christianity as a whole. So I think it'll be harder and harder for a political party to try to gain entry into the bloc at large and speak for all of them. And I think that's good news both for the attendee, the evangelical, and for political parties, so that people can't be co-opted.
Oh, and I wonder if that's going to mean that ultimately the Republican conservatives will have to find other groups with which to align their message going forward.
Yeah, I think especially as we see the Pew research that shows that younger folks, 40 and under, are not attending churches, and that churches like mine that are just getting started now are starting to use this post-evangelical language. I think what we're seeing is that it's just not going to work in 5 years from now. Some of the messages are losing messages for these parties, for this party in particular, today's GOP.
Lots to stay focused on. Chris Romine is an ordained minister at Common Ground. John Fia is a history professor at Messiah University. And Tara Isabella Burton is a journalist. Thanks so much to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm a Christian, and I go to church every Sunday,
And I believe in the sanctity of life. And I voted for Trump the last time, but I don't see him as a Christian. The things he does and the things he says are the antithesis of my Christianity, and I will not vote for him this time.
I'm from Dallas, Texas. My relationship with voting for president and my evangelical faith goes back to the last election, when after most of my evangelical community supported Donald Trump and I did not. And so after that, I actually left my evangelical faith, and I'm kind of left hanging in the balance of what to do with how I feel about my spirituality, given that the faith that I identified with supports someone that I find to be the antithesis of everything that I grew to love about the faith. So I will be supporting Joe Biden, and I still haven't decided where my faith lands today.
My name is Don Smith. I'm from Murray, Utah. And in regards to being a white evangelical, I have come to the point where I reject the title. Even though I am an evangelical, even though I am white, I am completely out of step. The term has become political party, in my opinion.
Hi, my name is Martin. I'm calling from Oregon City. And from a faith-based perspective, I'm an evangelical. From a constrained government fiscal responsibility, I'm Republican. And I value life. But I feel like life at all stages. And I feel the way our current president does not respect life at all stages, I cannot vote for him. And I'll be voting for Joe Biden.
Hi, my name is Jay. I'm calling from San Jose, California. And regarding being a person with evangelical values, but that does not want to vote for Trump, even though he checks the boxes ideologically on many things that I agree with, I just cannot trust him. I would prefer to vote somewhat for someone that I have more confidence in their integrity, in their honesty, in their accountability, and their transparency. And another good thing would be nice if they had a little bit of decorum.
On Tuesday, the United States Department of Justice filed a landmark lawsuit against Google, accusing the tech giant of abusing its monopoly in online search and search advertising. The lawsuit is the first ever antitrust action taken against Google, and it's also the largest antitrust case against any technology company in more than two decades. For more on what this means for big tech, I'm joined now by McKenna Kelly, politics reporter with The Verge. McKenna, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back.
So big news out of the Justice Department yesterday. What are they charging Google with specifically?
The Justice Department is charging Google with abusing a monopoly power that it created by using its Android products and putting Google as the default search engine on there, and just being extremely dominant in the advertising market as well. They are charging them in violation of Section 2 of the Sherman Act, which is pretty wonky, but it's the same kind of style of case that the DOJ pursued with Microsoft about 20 years ago.
Now, this isn't new, right? So hasn't the federal government been looking into Google for quite some time? And why is it the Department of Justice? Why isn't this more a Federal Trade Commission issue?
Right. So last summer, the Department of Justice announced that it was going to start a sweeping investigation into anti-competitive behavior in the tech industry. Now, Google is just one of the companies that it was looking at, but it was also looking at companies like Facebook, Amazon, and Apple as well. The Federal Trade Commission is kind of people like to call it a little bit of a toothless agency. And when it comes to the charges like the DOJ laid out yesterday in violation of Section 2 of the Sherman Act, that's a law enforcement task, right? So that's why the DOJ stepped up this week.
So how, I mean, we're just 2 weeks away from the presidential election. How politically motivated is this suit? I mean, this is something, again, as I mentioned, that, you know, Google has been eyed by the federal government in the past for having, you know, dominated the search industry world and also the advertising industry. But like, is this politically motivated? President Trump has had his eyes on big tech for a while.
So, of course, no one at the DOJ is going to say that, right? Bill Barr isn't going to say it. Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen is not going to say that it's politically motivated. But with the timing, 2 weeks until the election, with the president continuing to rail on big tech companies, kind of hitting a watershed moment last week with the Hunter Biden New York Post story with Facebook and Google and how they work to decrease its reach on their platforms, having this lawsuit pop up just barely a week later does kind of make things seem a little suspicious politically.
So what have we heard from Google so far about this?
So Google is taking the approach that a lot of companies do when they are threatened by antitrust action. You can't get mad at us for being big, right? That's basically what they've said. It's not illegal to be big. And it seems like that's
going
to be...
right?
Right. No, and it's not. And in the DOJ suit, they're basically saying that, no, you are big. But the problem here is abusing that bigness to stifle out competition and innovation.
So if one of the arguments is that Google on its Android phones installs Google as a search engine, people still have the opportunity to look at other search engines on their Android phones, don't they?
Right. So they would be able to, you know, go through any search engine. But the default thing, it's really hard to get past a default. This is the same kind of thing that happened with Microsoft 20 years ago with its Internet Explorer browser, when there are also other browsers like Opera being more difficult to buy. When that's when you had to buy software in stores, right? So it was a little bit more difficult than with Google going to download, you know, a separate app. But the argument is still there. And I think that's kind of what the DOJ is pursuing.
How likely is this to head to court?
There is a lot of people wanting it to be. There is bipartisan consensus between a lot of lawmakers to push this through. It hasn't just been Republicans investigating big tech. I mean, in the primaries, we had Elizabeth Warren call for break up big tech. The House Judiciary Committee has been investigating big tech companies for over 16 months now. It will go to court. I think, as far as I know, I think Google has about 30 to 60 days to respond. Now, this is going to be a very lengthy process, right? This isn't going to be solved today, tomorrow, next week, next month. This is going to be years and years of litigation.
And I've been talking to McKenna Kelly, a politics reporter with The Verge, about the Justice Department's antitrust lawsuit against Google. But now there's also another recent development in big tech. And that's last week, Ajit Pai, who's the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, announced that he's going to look into, quote, clarifying the meaning of Section 230, the 1996 Communications Decency Act. McKenna, that sounds a little wonky. What is Ajit Pai wanting to do, and what is this Communications Act?
So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act basically says that big companies, tech companies like Facebook, Twitter, Google, cannot be held liable for the content their users post on their platform. So basically, if I went to Facebook and I said something defamatory about you, you could sue me, but you could not sue Facebook.
Interesting. And so why is this an issue for the Federal Communications Commission?
Right. Well, traditionally, it hasn't been. In May, Donald Trump signed an executive order basically prompting the FCC to do this. The FCC, it covers more broadband issues, you know, telecommunications issues, but it's never had any role in regulating social media companies like this. Now, my understanding is that last week, Ajit Pai got word that the general counsel at the FCC says that they do have jurisdiction, is not illegal for them to act here. So I think that's basically the basis that they're working on. But traditionally, this has not been an FCC issue.
And because of that, I mean, similar to what we're asking about Google, these are issues that are coming up with just weeks before the election with, frankly, the incumbent president, Donald Trump, is trailing behind Joe Biden in many states right now. Is this, I know we the FCC probably won't admit to this, McKenna, but does your reporting suggest that this also might be politically motivated?
See, what happened last week with the Hunter Biden New York Post story with Twitter shutting it down and not being able to send the link in DMs, and with Facebook going to decrease its reach, for a lot of more, you know, populist-leaning Republicans who have already been on board, they were very excited to attack this, right? They were already, you know, have been making these arguments against conservative bias and big tech. At the FCC, there has only really been one commissioner who really has cared about the Section 230 issue, and that's Brendan Carr. He has been the one internally pushing for the FCC to kind of take initiative here. Ajit Pai, it doesn't seem like he really wanted to do anything before the election, but with what happened last week with Twitter and Facebook and the Hunter Biden story, I think for Pai, it was a watershed moment, and now no action is going to be taken on this. They're not going to reinterpret it in the next few weeks, and definitely not before the election. But I think it was a signal and a message from Pai that now they take it seriously, that last week was the tipping point.
What exactly are they? I mean, this isn't the first time in recent weeks that Section 230 has been in the spotlight. I mean, has the Trump administration has said other things about this Section 230?
Right. So, I mean, it seems like every other week President Trump is tweeting repeal Section 230 in all caps. But for the past couple years, it seems, the Trump administration first put out a weird kind of survey for people to take, I think in the summer of 2019, to say whether or not they have been censored or banned or suspended or shadow banned and all of these terms Republicans like to throw around. And so you can make a complaint to the White House. And then in May, President Trump signed a social media executive order after Twitter had first taken action against one of his tweets. Now, they had pretty much never wanted to touch the president's tweet, Twitter, but he was saying some things about mail-in voting that went too far. And when that happened, the president signed an executive order, basically prompting the process that we're seeing taking place this week. So the order told the FCC to reinterpret the law. The FCC, you know, has some ability to decide when and when they don't pick it up and take it forward. But this week, I mean, last week, last Friday was when they decided, okay, here we go. We're going to do it.
So if the president gets reelected in the next couple of weeks, what happens to Section 230? Or if he doesn't get reelected, what happens to Section 230? Have the Democrats and Joe Biden set their sights on this part of the law?
Right. So in an interview with the New York Times a couple months ago, Joe Biden also said that he wanted to revoke Section 230. Now, there is no policy plan on his website that really addresses it, but it could be on the table in a future Biden administration. Also, I mean, in the past couple months, we have seen a bunch of Democrats responding to Republican calls for amending 230. But they come from a way of thinking of where they don't want disinformation and misinformation and election falsities being posted on social media. And they would amend Section 230 in a way that prohibits that kind of content, opposed to this kind of weird, biased, ambiguous argument that Republicans are making.
McKenna Kelly is a politics reporter for The Verge. McKenna, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good to be here.
It's not controversial to say that 2020 has been a rough year, and things don't exactly feel like they'll be picking up anytime soon. The coronavirus continues to surge throughout the country as the U.S. surpasses more than 220,000 deaths from COVID-19. And last week alone, 17 states reported record numbers of new cases. Experts are warning that the rising number of cases is likely to get worse as we head closer to the winter and spend more time indoors. And yet, despite the bleakness of the pandemic and the prospect of spending more time apart from family and friends, there is hope that this won't last forever. Donald McNeil Jr. is a science and health reporter for the New York Times, and he recently wrote an article called A Dose of Optimism as the Pandemic Rages On, where he outlines the strides and advancements we have already made fighting the coronavirus since the pandemic began, and how this rapid progress may in fact indicate the pandemic could be over sooner than we thought. Donald joins me now. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Tanzina. How are you?
So, why did you write this article? I mean, there's so much fear about this, and we're reading now that the United States is, you know, anchored into a third wave. So why did you think it was important to go and write this piece?
I didn't so much go to write it as I was talking in a departmental meeting at the Times about why I was optimistic in the long term. And there was this kind of moment of shock among the editors saying, Donald, you? Because I've been the, you know, the gloomy Cassandra of this thing since January, saying it's going to be really bad. And I look, I'm not a Pollyanna. This winter is going to be bad. There's no question about it. And people need to be really careful. As, you know, as Tony Fauci says, we need to hunker down. But I have high hopes for January, February, for and ultimately for this all to be over sometime in the first half of next year, I hope. Because I think monoclonal antibodies are going to be approved pretty soon. And I think, although there will be very small amounts in the beginning, they can make a difference depending on how they're deployed. And I also see, you know, of seven vaccine candidates that are being worked along, some of them have got to work. And if only three of them will work, we'll have enough doses for all Americans by sometime next year. And I think people will take them. So it's despite the skepticism now. So long term, I'm optimistic.
So there's definitely a lot of skepticism about so much of this, and partly that's also because our officials, our federal officials, have also given mixed messages. We've heard things from the CDC that are different from what the Trump administration is saying, and on. But broadly speaking, is the United States more effective at combating the coronavirus now than it was in March, particularly when it comes to how doctors and nurses are treating patients?
Yes. I mean, we're more effective in many ways, and there's been lots of resistance. I mean, we learned that masks work, and frankly, I think, you know, the FAA should have immediately issued orders that everybody has to wear a mask on an airplane, you know, or they go on the no-fly list. I think, you know, subways and buses and everybody, masks should have become mandatory. They didn't. I mean, it's because of the resistance in the country. We've been slower than we might have, but we're getting better. More people are wearing masks, you know, despite what you see at Trump rallies, just generally across the country, a lot of people, especially older people, are wearing them. And also, if you get the disease and you end up hospitalized, we're doing better at saving you. We're, you know, knowing when to use dexamethasone, knowing when to use remdesivir, although that's a little controversial now about how well it works, proning people. People are getting to hospitals earlier because they're using pulse oximeters to realize they've got pneumonia. We're doing better just on the front, even better than we did in spring. And then, you know, we've produced a bunch of vaccine candidates, you know, many more than any other country in the world other than China. And we're taking more time to test ours, which is the ethical thing to do. And, you know, some of them have got to work. No vaccine is perfect and no vaccine is without any side effects. But, you know, it's a whole lot better than letting the disease wash through.
According to a CNN poll, only 51% of people surveyed said they would get a coronavirus vaccine. Where do you think that skepticism is coming from mainly?
I think that skepticism is because there's a combination of natural fear of vaccines that's going on in this country, unfortunately, preyed on by the anti-vaxxers lobby. But there's also, you know, there's the fear that the president was going to rush a vaccine out before it was ready in order to help himself get reelected. And yeah, if that happened, I'd be skeptical. I wouldn't take it if it was only I'm Donald Trump and I approve this vaccine. But once we get through the trials and once, you know, serious, legitimate doctors who understand vaccinology, like Tony Fauci, like Francis Collins, you know, Paul Offit, Peter Hotez, people you're used to seeing on on TV talking about this, once they say it's good, I'll be in line, and I think other millions of Americans will. And then, assuming nothing goes wrong, and that's you know, assuming nothing goes wrong, but I don't think anything really unexpected will go wrong because we know a lot more about making vaccines than we used to. And the phase one and the phase two data and the monkey data all looked pretty good. But assuming nothing goes wrong, once people see that, gee, you know, a lot of my neighbors have gotten this vaccine and nothing terrible's gone wrong for them, and I can either take this vaccine that I'm a little scared of, or I can wear a mask for the next 5 years and homeschool my kids and never go to a movie and never go out to a restaurant and never fly on an airplane, I think a lot of people will get over their skepticism. You know, this is like when I was a kid and, you know, polio vaccine came into existence. Well, things went wrong with the polio vaccine. Some kids died with a bad manufacturing accident. But people were so terrified of polio because they'd gone through it. You know, they'd seen kids in iron lungs, they'd seen kids die, they'd seen kids walking on crutches, that parents lined their kids up in droves to get polio vaccine back then. It was a different era, but that was a real disease, and this is a real disease. We haven't really faced anything like this since the 1950s.
Are we as Americans getting better at being able to cope with this? And what I mean by that, Donald, is that back in February, March, I remember, you know, everybody was just scrambling to get groceries and scrambling to, you know, even figure out what a mask was and how to make one and where to get one. And as we head into, we've now been in this for about 7 months. We're heading into the winter and the fall. I mean, we're in the fall, we're heading into the winter. I, for one, have been slowly, you know, stocking up the pantry and trying to make sure that, yes, indeed, I have enough toilet paper without hoarding, but making sure we're prepared. Are American, is that part of the reason to be optimistic as well, Donald, that Americans for this phase are at least maybe better at preparing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people who have the sense not to get caught up in the politics of it and not to make it all about a fight about whether to wear a mask or not because of what it says about who you support for the presidency, people who can avoid that, I think, have now gotten, just as you said, used to the idea of, I need so much toilet paper, I need so much food, I can go shopping in a safe way. I do know, you know, who I think is safe to hang out with because I know they're being really careful, and who I don't think is safe. The mistake is when you know, people who drop their guard or think they're immune and go to parties. And this actually, small parties is one of the main spreading events. The CDC said this just last week, that people who are holding slumber parties or birthday parties or just, you know, cocktail parties, and, you know, that's where you have, you know, 90% of them are okay, but the other 10%, there's a super spreader event. And I know this happened to the friends of my girlfriend's son in Brooklyn just recently, that they held a party, and I'm glad he didn't go because he's a smart guy. But, you know, the 7 people from the party got infected, and some of them, one of them seriously ill. So that but most people are being very careful about this. And a few of those, you know, when people you know get stung and somebody gets sick and somebody gets hurt, you kind of figure out that that was dangerous and maybe you'll be more sensible next time. So I'm hoping that people are learning the lessons now from seeing the disease spread out.
The president of the United States himself has gotten the coronavirus. At least that's what we understand. And he has made a big effort to say that it's okay, that people shouldn't be afraid of it. He's given conflicting messages about whether or not to wear a mask in public, and has essentially downplayed some of the risks here. Is there room to be optimistic if President Trump is reelected?
I get in trouble at times by commenting on politics, so I'm going to
stay away
from
this re-election. That's okay. If you don't feel comfortable, that's fine.
But I will tell you, from a medical point of view, from the president is dead wrong about not worrying about the virus. I mean, he was very sick. He doesn't want to admit that, but the fact that the doctors gave him remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies and dexamethasone indicates that something was going seriously wrong, and he needed oxygen, and that was pretty fast. He got the monoclonal antibodies. That didn't surprise me. You know, he tweeted at 1 o'clock in the morning that he was infected. I woke up at 5 because I don't sleep very much. Immediately went to my computer and wrote to our White House correspondents, you know, Maggie Haberman and Peter Baker, hey, ask whether or not he gets monoclonals, because if I was his doctor, that's what I would do. You know, you've got a patient, you know, ethically, you should only get them in the context of a clinical trial. But, you know, when you're president, you can do things. You can get things that the average Americans can't get. He got a drug that average Americans cannot get. There are only about 50,000 doses of that drug in the whole country right now. So people who get the virus are not going to get this, what may be one of the Lazarus drugs. And so they need to, I mean, he could have had a really bad outcome, and Chris Christie could have had a really bad outcome, and he got Eli Lilly's drugs, the other ones, the same ones, monoclonal antibodies, and he recovered. That's not going to happen to everybody. Those drugs, there are not enough of them available for everybody, so people need to take this seriously.
What should we, is there one thing that you're not so optimistic about? That you think people need to do better about, or anything that we should really continue to be vigilant, other than, of course, the threat of the virus?
People need to stop being so resistant to the idea of wearing masks, you know, when they're indoors. And people need to understand that forming in groups indoors is dangerous. You know, outdoors, okay, the wind blows away the cloud of droplets that comes out of the one person in the room who might be spewing virus. And so there's very little chance of it. But indoors, this droplet cloud could hang in the air for many minutes, and people inhale little bits of it. And you can have, you know, we've seen rooms where between 30 and 50 people were all infected in the same room from one person spreading virus. You know, that church choir episode was an example of that. That's really dangerous, and people need to pay attention to that. It's serious. It can happen to you.
Let's hope people remember that as we head into the colder months. Donald McNeil Jr. is a science and health reporter for the New York Times. Donald, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
And on that somewhat optimistic note, that's all we've got for our show today. We really appreciate you tuning in. And of course, you can continue to call us about your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you tomorrow.